They say Chuck walks on the water and Clancy walks underneath it, right underneath him. So I'm going to give you Chuck C. from Laguna Beach, California. I don't have to be to work until Thursday afternoon. It's up to you. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Chuck C., and I'm an alcoholic. Hi. You know, the first liar, the first alcoholic speaker, doesn't have a chance. That delinquent truant from the fourth grade who talked here last night did a pretty good job, you know. He really did. But he didn't know what he was talking about. I spilled more liquor than he drank. And that blonde broad that talked this afternoon. She got drunk for 10 days once. She was on a 10-day drunk. Hell, I had convulsions that ran more than that. Yeah. That other 90-90s that you heard, I taught her everything she knows. So Marty says if his pigeons left, we wouldn't have any meaty. If it hadn't been for me, you certainly wouldn't have had any conference up here. We got an old boy down in Arkansas. His name's Buttermilk. Buttermilk. He was introducing me down in Hot Springs. And he says we've had a pretty good go here until now. And he says we'll finish up all right if old Goober here don't foul us up. Marty pretty near fouled me up, you know. I didn't want you to know that I walk on the water. J.B., who used to have the program King for a Day or something like that, he says that I went out for a walk and a boat ran over me. But that really isn't true. The boat hit me, but it sank. It's a beautiful place here. Mrs. C. and I have had a beautiful time with y'all. We're most grateful to you for having us come out here. I've been looking for Bear ever since I got here. And I left just before it came down through the woods. One of our friends had one come right through the woods there this afternoon. Just after I left, I'm sure he was not looking for me. It wouldn't have done him any good anyway. Because I can outrun any bear you got in the state. Without half trying, and I would. I had to wait for my wife to get through and walk down from cabin 12 to 17 last night. I was afraid to walk down there alone. By the grace of God, through the miracle of this program, and through the help of people like you, it hasn't been necessary for me to take a drink of liquor or a sedating or tranquilizing pill for something around 9,500 days. Now, lest you get all mixed up in arithmetic and miss my profound message, that's something over 25 years and 8 months. And for a tongue-chewing, babbling idiot drunk like me, that's pretty good. That's 25 years and 8 months that I would not have had it not been for the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I am one of the most grateful men that ever lived. Because, you see, I spent the 10 years before I got here trying to prove that this was not what it is, a killer disease, a terminal illness. I had never heard that expression, but I gave everything I had to the fight to prove that it wasn't true. I analyzed myself 10 years before I got here because I had had a code for drinking, just as I'd had a code for everything else in life. And I'd lived according to my code pretty well for the first 15 years of my drinking. But after 15 years, something happened, and I wasn't drinking according to my code. And I didn't like what was going on. So I had a session with me, and I decided that this was a personal weakness, something that I had to overcome to get rid of. I did not think that total abstinence was the way out. I thought that any weakling could quit drinking. But it took a pretty good man to meet this thing head on and beat it. And that's what I proceeded to try to do. Now, I worked on my problem very hard for the next 10 years. And the harder I worked, the worse it got. And the worse it got, the harder I worked. And I'm quite sure that in the last 5 years that I drank, 90% of my waking time was spent on the problem. And the farther backwards I went, the more necessary it was for me to win this battle. I had to win. I was saying to myself 5 years after everybody quit listening to me, I'll beat this thing if it's the last thing I ever do. And it came that close to being the last thing I ever did. Now, as long as I had the power of choice, I could not look into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. As long as I had the power of choice, my choice was never to come to this program. And I didn't come until I ran out of everything, including the power of choice. And that time, that happened to me in January 1946. I ran out of everything that there was. And there wasn't any place else for me to go but here. Now, the thing that has been uppermost in my mind ever since January 1946 is what has to happen to people like you and to me before we can obtain and maintain sobriety. I have been very... much concerned about all the other approaches to this thing of ours. I get most upset when I hear those who would tell us that we have to join hands with all the other agencies in the alcoholism and allied disorders field. And I hear so much of it, so much rumbling. I left Toronto, Canada, with the most uneasy feeling, because I heard people up there who should know better telling us that we had to take off our wraps. And some of them even that we must do away with our anonymity. And these things are most precious to me. They're my life's blood. And when I hear things like that, I want to do something. Do something about it. And there's so little we can do. There is so little. I guess it's about a year ago now. Mrs. C and I were in Duluth, Minnesota. And the first speaker, the Friday night speaker, who should have been able to hear our man last night, he was a non-alcoholic preacher. He was heading up a rehabilitation program, perhaps for the state or for the federal government, I don't know what. And he got up there on Friday night and was telling about this rehab deal. And he said, Alcoholics Anonymous is working hand in glove with us in our program. And I almost fell out of my seat. Because, you see, Alcoholics Anonymous don't do that. And he went ahead and told how we were going to have to get with it, join the other approaches to this disease. And he ended up by saying that it was no longer necessary for us to be ashamed of our membership in Alcoholics Anonymous, that we must do away with our anonymity. And this really did me in. Now, that was on Friday night, and I talked Sunday morning. And it'd be rather interesting for me to know whether he was there or not. Oh, God, I did take that guy apart. From up here and in a state that wasn't even mine. But to think that anybody in this day and time would think that you and I are anonymous because we're ashamed of our membership in Alcoholics Anonymous, or even ashamed of the fact that we're alcoholics. I'm an alcoholic of the tongue chewing, babbling idiot variety, and I'm neither proud of it nor am I ashamed of it. That's the way it is with me. I am an alcoholic, and it's the easiest thing I say. Because when I could not say it, I was drunk all the time. And now that I can say it, I don't have to drink anymore. And it fits right in with the first condition for sobriety. And that is that we accept ourselves exactly as we are where we are tonight. That we accept ourselves exactly as we are where we are tonight. This is the first step in recovery. You know, we're in a trap that we cannot spring. There's no way that you and I can get out of this thing alone. If we could, we wouldn't need Alcoholics Anonymous. It's necessary for us to have help. And we cannot get help until we recognize the need for it. We heard Jack struggle last night. How he beat his brains out and could not recognize the need for help. I did the same thing. I died 10,000 deaths because I could not admit defeat. And I never did it. Not one time in 43 years of life. I never surrendered once to God, man, woman, or the devil in the first 43 years of my life. And thank God I didn't have to do it the first time consciously. Thank God, because I would have died before I came here, admitting defeat if I'd had to done it consciously. But the bottle beat me to death. On my last trip out, it killed me. It beat me into total and absolute nothingness. And I came here surrendered. Now, I suspect that this is the reason that I have been so slap happy for 25 years and 8 months. Because the first time I ever heard the conditions, the fifth chapter of our book, read, everything in it was something I wanted to do. And I'm sure it was because of the state of total abandonment of self in which I got here. And it was not because I was wise. It was because the bottle had beaten me to death. Now the book tells us, we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic. This is the first step in recovery. To accept ourselves exactly as we are where we are tonight. To recognize the need for help. Because we can't get it until we do. The second condition is that sobriety must come first. And I am one who believes that unless and or until sobriety comes first, we can't have it. And unless it remains first, we cannot keep it. And the book puts that like this. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. Have decided to go to any length or are willing to go to any length to get it, that puts it tops. High man on the totem pole. And I'm one who believes, as Jack told us last night, that when sobriety is more important to us than life itself, we neither have to drink or die. Something happens. There is a miracle here. And these two things almost have to happen to us before we can say, I am an alcoholic. If anyone of you had called me an alcoholic 30 years ago, and I could have gotten up off the floor, I'd have kicked you right in the teeth if I could have seen you. This is something nobody must know, not even me. And we went to any lengths to keep anybody from knowing it. Something has to happen before we can say, I'm an alcoholic. And I believe that it's necessary that we either drink the last dregs out of the bottom of the cup or we come to see the nature of our problem. That there is nothing ahead of us but permanent insanity or an alcoholic death. We gotta come to see this. Lest we have to drink the last dregs out of the bottom of the cup, or we will not do the things necessary to obtain and maintain sobriety. Because, you see, we are not people who can and do surrender easily. We don't run around admitting defeat. That's not one of our long suits. And the first condition for sobriety is surrender. For the alcoholic, surrender is victory. And I've been thinking now for many, many years. I would rather be able to explain to one audience what it means to surrender than to be president of the world, of all its peoples. But it cannot be done. This is an experience that can only be known by doing it. And all we can do is to say this, that perhaps there is no peace of mind or serenity of purpose as long as it's necessary for us to satisfy the human ego. There's no way that we can have peace of mind and serenity of purpose. So surrender is the very essence of our new way of life. And this is why I get so perturbed about the other approaches, because I'm one who believes that there is no such thing as an answer to this thing called life. And that's what alcoholism is. It's a living problem. There is no such thing as an answer to this thing called life that does not include a personally acceptable, conscious partnership with the living God that made us in the entire business of living. It has to come about, in my way of thinking. We're only 10% alive until we discover who and what we are and our relationship to each other and to God. We're only 10% alive. And this is the great good fortune of those of us who find ourselves in Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the great good fortune. I think we're the luckiest people that live, the most fortunate segment of God's children. Why? Because we have a terminal illness, and because that illness is progressive, and because the time comes when it's no longer possible to survive without an answer. And we come here, what for? To find God? No, no, no. To get our wives back? No. To get our kids back? No. To get our job back? No. Peace of mind and serenity of purpose, never heard of it. We come here hoping against hope that we might find a way to live that don't include that flit. We've had it. And people like you, drunks who are not drunk, tell us, here are the things we did. If you want these things, do these things. That's what they told me. And I wanted what they had. And I became willing to go to any length to get it the first night I was here. And I attended meetings for 6 long months with the great fear upon me that I couldn't have this thing, because I didn't think I had enough left to get it. Because I, too, had burned up the body that I'd had and the mind that I'd had. It took me 3.5 years to get over falling on my face after my last drunk. It took me over 6 months to put the Serenity Prayer together in English. Not spiritually, in English. I couldn't make the thing make sense. People would get up here and talk about it, and I knew it was very meaningful to them. And I'd try so hard to make it fit, and the words didn't go together. But I wanted this thing so much that I was in a meeting every night for 6 months. with the great fear upon me that I couldn't have it. And after 6 months, I discovered that I was sober and had been for 6 months. And that was the first great discovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. That I hadn't had a drink or a pill for 6 months. And so, again and again and again. The necessity to recognize the need for help. Enough self-honesty to see ourselves as we are, and enough honesty to do something about it, namely, to practice these principles in all of our affairs one day at a time, to the best of our ability. When we get simple enough to do this, we're home free. And until we do, we haven't got a chance. Not just for fun. Let's look at the people around me. I'm an alcoholic. I was a manufacturer when I was in business. And I'm an alcoholic. My barber's an alcoholic. I brought him to the program 20 years ago, and I drive clear from Laguna Beach to the Barrington Plaza to get a haircut. That's 60 miles away, just to check up on my barber. See how he's doing. He's still sober after 20 years. My attorney is an alcoholic, member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My doctor is an alcoholic, medical doctor, a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My banker is an alcoholic, member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My dentist's wife died an alcoholic without coming to the program. My accountant's wife died an alcoholic without coming to the program. And that's just people right around me. And all of them tried to the best of their ability to keep from coming here. And they couldn't make it. And so, we're pretty fortunate. We're pretty fortunate. Now, how's a monkey like me, a tongue-chewing, babbling idiot drunk, going to get help from a power greater than ourselves? Because the book tells us that a lack of power was our dilemma. And if we lack the power, we have to find one. And if we find one, it has to be a power greater than we are. Obviously, says the book. Obviously. Now, I believe that. I believe it just as much as I believe that I'm here, and for just a simpler reason. The book says under certain conditions, certain circumstances, it seems there's only one defense against that first slug. The drink I must not take. And that's help from a power greater than we are. And this I believe. Because, you see, I gave everything I had to the fight. My wife, our kids, our home, my job, my health, my sanity, and my money. I gave to the fight. If there had been anything else to put in, I'd have put it in. But that's all there was. And I lost. I lost. All the rest of these people, and there are many of them much smarter than I. My banker is an international banker. He's known the world over. He was a dollar a year man with the government. And he couldn't make it. My favorite Jesuit priest, I don't happen to be Catholic, but I got me a favorite Jesuit priest. He's been 18 years a member of this society. Isn't that awful? He had everything in the world in his favor. He had the whole church helping him. They wouldn't help Jack because he wouldn't let them. But this old boy had them all trying to help him. And he didn't make it. He had to come here. And again and again and again. This is the thing. That seems to me to be so simple the rest of the world should see it. 25 years ago, 24 years ago, 23 years ago, I was saying the job of Alcoholics Anonymous is not to sober up a few drunks. This isn't our destiny. We can't fulfill our destiny, however, if we get interested in anything else whatsoever but carrying the message successfully to the alcoholic who still suffers. But that isn't our great destiny. Our great destiny is to usher in the next big step in the evolutionary process of man. And let's put God back in his creation where somebody took him out. I was going to say theology, but I mustn't do that. Because a lot of you go to church in the morning. But somebody put him someplace else. And I had an awful time. Because I started trying to find out how come I got gypped when I was 13 years old. And I went through all the great religions and all the great philosophies for 30 years trying to find an answer, and I couldn't find it. And it was not because they were no good. It was because I could not fulfill the first condition, and that was to get out of my own way in this thing called surrender. Now, this is a more or less sort of a retreat deal up here. And that's the reason I'm talking like this. Because again and again and again, our answer is impossible in my way of thinking without help from a power greater than herself. It's impossible. Now, for instance, why am I not drunk tonight? This is Saturday night. A tongue-chewing, babbling idiot drunk is not supposed to be sober on Saturday night. Thursday night's kickoff night. You know, you start oiling the machinery on Thursday night. Friday night, you get her into high gear. Saturday, you paint. Sunday, you taper off so you can go to work Monday. Now, that's some Sunday you can taper off so you can go to work some Monday. So why am I not drunk tonight, Saturday night? The only reason I'm not drunk is because I've got the thing I was looking for in the bottle. I've got the thing. Now, what is the thing? Well, that king-size hurt is gone. I don't hurt in here anymore. The thing that the youngsters call that hole in your gut. Out in my country, they say, I was standing on the street corner with a big hole in my gut and the wind blowing through. I didn't think they'd lived long enough to be able to say that. But I know what you're talking about. I don't have that anymore. I'm not fighting me or you or life or God or the devil. I am at peace with me and with you and with my very own God. And that's the only way that I could stay sober. That's the only reason I'm sober tonight. It's a state of being that makes a drink or a pill or pot or the needle or acid absolutely unnecessary. Because they can do nothing for me but tear me down. They cannot add to my life. They can only tear down. Because I've got the thing. It is a state of being. That is so good, those things have no appeal. Now, why was I drunk 30 years ago? For the same reason. A state of being that was so lousy I had to get drunk to get rid of it. To get rid of me. To get rid of the big hurt. So at that time, it was a state of being. And tonight, it's a state of being. One so lousy I had to get drunk to get rid of me. The other one so good that I couldn't get drunk. Because it's not necessary. You can add nothing to my life. And the difference in this is the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because, you see, you don't get over the disease of alcoholism. You get better, but you don't get well. There's no such thing as a cure for the disease of alcoholism. And the only difference between me right now and 25, 30 years ago is the miracle of AA. Tonight, without this thing, I'm a tongue-chewing, babbling idiot drunk. Because I can't run my life. I can't keep from drinking. Of myself, there's no way I can keep from drinking. And there's no way I can drink and live. So, physical sobriety is the very basis of the new life. Physical sobriety. Today is the day we don't drink. Physical sobriety is the very basis of the new life. Now, it isn't the new life, because I was physically as sober as them tonight between every two drunks for 10 years. Because I had a periodic for the last 10 years. And between every two drunks for 10 years, I was physically as sober as them right now. So it isn't the new life, but it's the basis of the new life. Without physical sobriety, we can't have the new life. So, physical sobriety and life itself are synonymous to me. I can't have one without the other. And so we start in right here on this level. Physical sobriety. We have a formula in our program for physical sobriety. And all we have to do is fulfill the conditions of the formula. Here are the steps we took. We're sober. The first two conditions we've already taken before we get to the first step. Or we take them before we can do the first step. That is to accept ourselves as we are, where we are in sobriety first. Physical sobriety first. Now, when we do these things for sobriety, lots of things happen to us that could not happen otherwise. Couldn't possibly happen otherwise. And so, whilst I said a while ago that I think it's absolutely necessary that we get help from a power greater than ourselves, I say right now that to get lost trying to get help from a power greater than ourselves probably is our greatest problem. Probably is our greatest problem. More people get hurt trying to somehow understand God or trying to go further than in any other way in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I came here with every problem you can have after 25 years drinking. Miss C was divorcing me, as she told you this afternoon. The kids wouldn't even come home when I was around if they could help it. My boss had sent word to the house that if I ever stepped foot in the plant again, he was going to throw me through the window. And the window to which he referred does not open. And he came in to do it, too, but he didn't. Something had happened, and he recognized it. No health, no sanity, no money, no job, no home, no nothing. But I came here for one thing, hoping against hope that I might find a way to live that did not include liquor. And I would have settled for the meanest old unhappy sobriety on the face of the earth, just as long as I didn't have to drink. And when you all told me, these are the steps we took, do these things, I didn't have any more sense than to do them. And I did them for sobriety and nothing else. Nothing else. Again, I was very fortunate because I didn't even want sobriety for myself. My last drunk had done me in. It was only about 4 weeks. I've total blackout. Started the Friday before Christmas, 1945, and ended up sometime after the middle of January, 46. Total blank. I don't remember anything about any of it. And I came to on this particular morning with something that couldn't possibly be explained. I had the clearest head that I've ever known in my life. I had nothing in my body but booze. I didn't eat when I drank. And there was nothing in me but booze. And yet I had the clearest head I've ever known. And for the first time in my life, I saw me as I was. There was nothing between me and me. The excuses were all burned up. They were gone. And I knew for the first time in my life that I'd lost the battle of life. I did not know why, because I knew nothing of the disease of alcoholism. But I knew that I'd lost the battle of life. I knew why my wife was divorcing me, and I knew she should have done it 10 years before. And I knew why my kids wouldn't come home when I was around. And I knew why the boss was going to throw me through the window. And I accepted the fact that morning that everything dear to me in life was gone and should be gone. And that I was not entitled to have it back. And it suddenly became very necessary that I be sober till I died. Now, I knew I was going to die. I'd come that close to it the time before. The oxygen squad had to wake me up after I turned blue, the next to the last time out. And so I knew I was going to die, and I didn't care. But I didn't want to die with a record. I didn't want the kids and their mother to remember me as nothing but a tongue-chewing, babbling idiot drunk. And I said to myself that morning, if I ever live to get out of this bed, I'll find Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, this is a strange thing, too, because the minute that decision, the minute that commitment had been made, the curtain dropped. And I was again sickened to death, drunk and insane. But from that second until right now, I have never had a drink or a sedating or tranquilizing pill. Now, this is the reason that I am so overboard on this thing called surrender. Oh, I had to die and die and die before I started to get well. Because those of you who have drunk some liquor know that every nerve center in my body was screaming for whiskey. And they say there are a few billion of them. But everything in me was, how long can I live without a drink? And somehow or another, I didn't have to take it. Now, on many occasions in the past, my mind would go and come like turning a light on and off in a withdrawal period. But this time it went and it didn't come. And I was pretty sure that this time the cord was broken, that I was going to remain insane for the rest of my life. This thing is funny for me. I can't hardly talk about it. You know, it's funny. 2 years ago, I was up at Edmond in Canada, yakking up there. And at dinner, at the banquet, I had 6-7 judges sitting around me. And we talked and had fun and figured out what they could do to help us, you know. And then it came my time to talk. And Premier Manning and his wife were sitting in the audience. And he's quite a talker in his own right. He's not only the premier, but he was a preacher. And he talked good. And there he sat with his wife out in the audience. There were at least 8 or 10 judges in the audience. The mayor of Edmonton and his wife were in the audience. All the preachers and priests from all the denominations but the Jewish were there. And this happened to be a day when the Jews couldn't come out until sundown. And the sun wouldn't go down that night up there. So they didn't come. But all the rest of them were there. And who was talking? Me. Some drink bottle and they did drunk. And I had a friend who couldn't hardly talk. It was a funny to me, I couldn't hardly talk. Isn't that the most incongruous picture you ever saw? Tongue-chewing, babbling, idiot, drunk. 4,000 miles from home. Talking to the Premier. The Monsignor. Yeah. That's what we're talking about. An answer to this thing called life. And that's what alcoholism is, a living problem. Now, the wonder is, again, that when you and I do the things that the program says, for sobriety, 1,000 things will happen to us. And they're all good. Now, let me tell you a few of them. If nothing had happened but the 9,500 days that I've had, that would be enough for me to thank God for the rest of my life, with every breath I draw. That's quite a while. Some people die before they have 25 years and 8 months of this thing called life, you know? And I've had 25 years and 8 months since I died. And that's pretty good. So that's the start. Now, I told you what the first discovery was, that I was sober after 6 months. Hadn't had a drink or pill. Now, that was the first great discovery. And that wasn't bad. The next discovery was that something had happened in the household. It seemed that the war was over, you know. They quit chasing me with a blue paper. And they sort of living like kittens in my household. And that wasn't a bad discovery. The third one, very likely, was that I was still down there trying to clean up the desk. Now, I had gone down there knowing that the boss was going to throw me through the window. But he had done something nice for me. The Friday before Christmas, he had paid me for something I didn't do. And I had to go down there to get even with him. And he came through that door of mine like a bull in the china closet. And he was going to throw me right through the window. And fortunately for me, I was on the telephone. And it was his phone, and he was a frugal man. And he didn't want to throw it through the window. So he got busy and moved my drafting boards out of the way so he'd have a clear shot at the window when I hung up. And I hung up and he started after me. And there was nothing I could do about it because, you see, I'd just been blackout drunk for 4 weeks. So I wasn't healthy. I was sort of puny. And all I could do is say, Victor, leave me alone. I don't work for you anymore. I'm down here to clean up this desk. I'm here to do the things you paid me for last year that I didn't do. And as soon as I get even with you, I'll get the hell out of here on my own power. And you'll never owe me a penny as long as you live. But for God's sake, leave me alone. I've got to get even with you. And the old boy stopped in his tracks and he says, what the hell's happened to you, Charlie? And I says, don't know. I don't know. But if you want to know what I do know, sit down and I'll tell you. And he sat down there by my desk. And I told him what I was going to try to do. And he got up an hour later and he was crying like a baby. And he stuck out his hand and he says, Charlie, if you're going to live like that, I want to live with you. And a few months later, I discovered that I was still down there trying to clean up my desk. And business was good. Things were going real good. And a few months later, maybe a year later, I discovered that the quality of my life, my being, was different. It was better than I'd ever known it in my entire life. And that was a good discovery. And the next one, it might now be 5 years, it might be 6 years, when I discovered I was never alone anymore. I was never alone anymore. I had a God of my very own, and wherever I was, he was. And what a discovery this is. This is the great discovery. And it all came out of doing these things for sobriety, every bit of it. Now I'm one who believes that when you and I get simple enough to do these things, as honestly as we know how for sobriety, everything that all the Bibles of the world promises, if we live correctly? Will happen in our own experience, the whole bunch of them. I could empty the biggest coliseum in the country in 45 minutes' time by just starting to tell them what's happened to me in the last 25 years and 8 months. And they wouldn't believe it, and nobody would believe it, except people like you, who know the miracles that happen amongst us. It's fantastic. And it's so simple that we can't believe it. We can't see it. It's too simple. Now, I'm going to quote a couple of Catholics. Again, I'm not a Catholic, so I can quote them, and you can't accuse me of proselyting. One of these guys named Brother Lawrence. Brother Lawrence lived in 1666. He wasn't even a priest. He was just a brother. He was a Carmelite brother. The reason for the Carmelites' existence, as I understand it, or misunderstand it, is the practice of the presence of God. The practice of the presence of God. Now, they think that's religion, but you and I know that it's AA. No. They're confused. Well, Brother Lawrence practiced it like we should. He was a kitchen mechanic. He washed pots and pans, and he's back there in the corner washing these pots and pans, and everybody's wanting something. He said, I didn't pay attention to him. I just went ahead about my business talking to God. He says, I didn't even know where my prayers of office started and stopped, and my prayers began. And he was a pretty happy guy. And he was talking to one of his troubled friends, and he says to him, if you would find God, look deeper than yourself. Because it's the only place you're ever going to find him. If you would find God, look deeper than yourself, because it's the only place you're ever going to find him. And then there was another monkey. He was a priest. He was a Dominican. He lived in Germany a few hundred years ago. And he said it like this. He says, you have heard that nature abhors a vacuum. I tell you that God abhors a vacuum and can't abide a vacuum any place under heaven, however small. Now, says he, all you have to do is move out, get empty of self, and automatically you're full of God. That comes nearer explaining the little experience I had in January 1946 than anything I ever heard or read. Carpenter knew about those things, too. He said, I'm the Father, and he and me and I and you. He says, the kingdom of heaven's within you, you know. And so, these are the things we discover. Alcoholics Anonymous is uncovering, discovering, and discarding. That's our program. The first 9 steps of the program are the uncovering steps. The uncovering steps. They squeeze us right out of ourselves if we do them. When you and I take the first 9 steps honestly, at 10 we are surrendered. We are empty of self. That's what they're for. To squeeze us right out of ourselves. So that's the uncovering process. Now we can look deep within ourselves and find ourselves, which includes our relationship to each other and to God. And this is the great discovery. And from then on, our job mainly is to discard the things we were taught that were conditions to this thing called life, that are entirely contrary to our living experience. For instance, I was born in a family that was too poor to paint and too proud to whitewash. We didn't have from nothing. Old Lazarus would have given us a handout if he'd come by. Really? And since we had nothing, we were conditioned to believe that we must get the things that marked success. For instance, money, position, recognition, power. These things we must get in order to live. And in order to get them, we had to equip ourselves with a good education so that we could outthink, outperform, and outmaneuver the rest of the world, so we could get there first and get the worm. You know, the devil takes the hindermost. You got to be there firstest with the mostest. So you got to be able to outperform, outmaneuver, and outthink your competition to eke a miserable living out of an unfriendly universe. Now, I worked at that for 30 years. I was on my own at 13, and I ended up at 43. 30 years I beat my brains out to get the things I thought I was born without. And I ended up in the bottom of the snake pit. Now, I never was a fast buck artist. I never was a confidence man. I worked hard to get. And I ended up a total failure in every department of life. Failure as a husband, a father, a businessman, man, and drunk at 43. And I started doing things 25 years and 8 months ago, like you guys told me. I had to start at home because there's where I'd done the most damage. To make amends, I had to try to do something for somebody without a price tag on it. Because I was trying to rub out. And you're not thinking, I want, I don't want, when you're trying to rub out. You're trying to do something for somebody without a price tag on it. So that was my work at home. My business was the same thing, because the boss had done something nice for me. And I'd gotten drunk that very day that he did it. And I hadn't shown up from the Friday before Christmas, the last of January. And he'd missed it. He'd missed me. For some reason or another. So I had to do the same thing down there. To do something for somebody without a price tag on it. To rub out a record. And that's all I've done for 25 years and 8 months. My life has been nothing but one 12-step call. At home, in business, in play, in Alcoholics Anonymous, in life. That's all it's been for 25 years and 8 months. And infinitely more good has come into my life than in the entire previous 43 years. And it all came from the same horn. And so if every authority and every book on earth said this was a getting life, I'd laugh out loud. I know better. It never was a getting life. It has forever been a giving life. And the more we pour out without a price tag on it, the more we have. And that's just the way it is. How do I know? All I have to do is look at my own life, look at my own books. And there it is. And so we discard the old ideas, the conditions of life. And the more we discard, the freer we become. And this goes on forever. Now, a couple of little things, and I'm going to quit. Again and again and again. We must have physical sobriety, or we can't live if we be alcoholics. We cannot live without it. And in order to get it, we have to have a personally acceptable, conscious partnership of the living God that made us. But the great key, the golden key to this whole thing, is not the 30 years I spent in the religions and the philosophies. Oh, I don't sell them short. They mean a great deal to my personal livingness now. So I don't sell them short. But that wasn't the thing. The golden key to this thing called life is rigorous self-honesty. Rigorous self-honesty. Why? Because we had a monitor with us. We had nothing to do about it. He's always been here. What is peace of mind? It's performance according to the best we know, according to the pattern. And the pattern's right here. You know, the carpenter said it. He says, it's not in the mountain, it's not in the temple, it's not in Jerusalem. It's in your own mouth. So we have a monitor with us. The pattern is right here. And when I perform according to the pattern, there seems to be a nod of approval from the universe. And that's called peace of mind. It's not a thing. It's a byproduct of walking in this way. Rigorous self-honesty. And when I perform less than my best, the old sausage grinder's right here, too, and it starts going and it says, oh, Chuck, why'd you do it? Why'd you do it? Why'd you do it? And in order to get rid of it, I have to see it for what it is. I have to decide to do better, and by the grace of God, do better. And then it disappears. So the golden key is not that we have to run out and find out a lot of things and read lots of books. But we have to get honest enough to perform according to pattern. It's right here. Now again, our great good fortune. We have to find this thing where it is. I've had a little fun up here because I've seen quite a number of your deer. You can have the bear. But I love your deer. I just love deer. We have a lot of them in our canyon down there, and I'm always looking for them. Every time I go through the canyon, I'm looking for deer. And they taught me a great lesson, the deer. You see, I'm a Cherokee Indian, and I've learned more from deer and animals and birds and bees and fish about what to do in this thing called life than I have from people. I learn more from people what not to do. So I always look for deer when I go through the valley, through that canyon, you know. And I invariably look for them where I saw them last. And I invariably see them someplace else. And on this particular trip, no self-respecting deer had been out anyway, because it was late in the morning. But I looked just the same. And as long as I was where there was cover, I kept looking for deer, and there weren't any. Well, when I got out of the cover, and it must have been 10, 11 o'clock, I knew that there would be no deer out there. So I quit looking. And I was driving along and glance out in the country there, out in the field, and right out there where there wasn't hardly a blade of grass stood the nicest big old fat buck you ever saw. And so he told me this. He says, you see them where they are. You know? You don't see them where you think they are or where you saw them yesterday. You see them where they are. And before I got to town, which was 57 miles away, I'd carried this through every relationship in life. You see them where they are. And you find them where they are. Here, I had been searching for God for 30 years, and I couldn't find him, because I had him located someplace else. I was looking yonder. And the funny part of it is, you know, as long as you look yonder, you can't find. Because what you're looking for, you're looking with. Uh-oh. What you're looking for, you're looking with. And so I couldn't find him. And I came here not looking for him at all. And got mixed up with the one segment of the human race that I hated worse than all the rest of them put together. The drunks of the world. I didn't like drunks, because I was a drunk and I hated me, so I hated all drunks. And this is the reason I couldn't come here as long as I had the power of choice. Well, when I ran out of everything, including people and choice, I came. People like you took me on their laps and rocked me to sleep. Didn't ask me anything, but, mister, were you looking for somebody? I said, no, sir. Well, he said, what were you looking for? And thinking that the guy was a veteran because it was in the Veterans of Foreign War at Hall. And I knew they weren't drunks because they didn't look like me and they didn't feel like me and they weren't dressed like me. And they weren't talking like me. So I knew they were veterans with their wives and they were there for a party. And I said to the guy, if it would interest you, sir, I was looking for sobriety. And he lit up like a Christmas tree. Everything about the guy changed. He lit up. And he said to me, why, take off your hat and coat. You're in the right place. And he took me and rocked me to sleep. The people that knew me wouldn't even look at me, including my own wife and my own kids. Here's a man I'd never seen before in my life. Took me in and rocked me to sleep. So I got interested in them because they were interested in me. And when I got interested in them, I had to love them because they loved me. And when I found that I was sober, when I discovered that I was sober, I had to start trying to give this thing away. And I got lost trying to give it away. And I discovered that I had a God of my own. I found him where he was, right here. Right here. Wherever I am, he is. Now, for a guy that walked alone for 43 years, this is tremendous. I'm often alone anymore. Often by myself, but I'm never alone. Never alone, because he's with me. All the time. Now, I have a easy little thing, a very simple way to go about this. I talk with him easier than I talk with you. And I have lots of fun. I share everything in life with him. I share the bad and the good and the indifferent. Everything in life I share with my very own God. I'm driving through that canyon. Lots of times I suspect that people think I'm pretty nuts. Because there'll be nobody in the car as far as they're concerned but me. And I'm liable to be riding through there bawling. And I might be laughing out loud. And I might just be talking to somebody. And they wouldn't see him, you know. And they think, well, the guy's nuts. But I'm saying something like this. Look, Dad, I'm reporting for duty. I'm reporting for duty. Now I'm going to move it around. I'm going to do the best I can with what I got. All I want out of you is a little guidance and direction, power to carry it out. Sure, thank you, and I go about my business. All day long. In total expectancy of guidance and direction. I've lived by step 11 for 25 years. Without it, I couldn't live. Because I can't run my life, I can't run yours, can't run my wife, can't run my business, can't run nothing. But I don't need to, because you see, I have step 11. Praying only for knowledge, his will for us, and the power to carry it out. Now, when I do a lousy thing, and I do them, I talk that over. I say, look, Dad, look what I did. Now, isn't this a lousy thing for a guy like me to do? I know better. I even know why I did it. And I don't like it. And you don't like it, and I'm going to do better. And with your help, I'll do a lot better. Sure, thank you, and I dump it. And I never pick it up again. Gone. And when the good thing happens, like this, I share this. I say, look, Father, isn't this a beautiful thing? It couldn't happen to a bum like me, but it did. And I know where it came from. Sure, thank you. And I dump that, and I never pick it up again. Because, you see, I think it's just as bad for us to try to carry the so-called good that we do as the so-called bad. So we dump them, and we stay free to live today, this day, to the best of our ability, practicing these principles in all of our affairs, one day at a time. It's a fantastic way of life. I'm certain in my own mind that the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous includes everything that is needful in your life and mine, that we include in it. Excludes only those things that you and I exclude, because that's the way it's been in my life. And I'm mindful of a couple of little things. One of them, fear not, little flock. It's the Father's good pleasure to give us the kingdom. Now, the carpenter said that. Fear not, little flock. It's the Father's good pleasure to give us the kingdom. But not on our terms. On His. And what are His terms? It's so simple, we can't see it. The world can't see it. All we got to do is to go about His business. To help His kids do things that they need to have done because we want to. One day at a time. That's my business, and it's His business to take care of me. That is not my business. This is my business, to walk in this way. And I'm mindful again of a little thing. Remember, the carpenter had 12 guys that sort of worked with him when he was around here. And one of them was sort of a maverick. He just might have been an alky, I don't know. Because when he got caught with the goods, you know, he lied out of it. Just like you and I. He lied out of it. Don't know these guys, never saw them before, you know. But because he was a maverick, I think maybe the carpenter loved him better than some of the rest of them. So it was about time for him to go. And he called Peter in. And he says, Peter, do you love me? And Peter says, yea, Lord. And he said to him, tend my sheep. And he turned around and asked him again, Peter, do you love me? He says, yea, Lord. Again, he says, tend my sheep. And the third time, he says, Peter, do you love me? Yea, Lord, tend my sheep. Now, that sort of makes me believe he meant tend my sheep, you know. And you and I could pretty nearly change the 12th step like this. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to tend His sheep and practice these principles in all of our affairs. This is AA. And I would say to you in leaving, all of our early birds, that is, the ones we know so well, have left us now. Bill, our number one man, left this year. Dr. Bob had already gone. Sister Ignatia, Father Dowling, Dr. Silkworth, Ebby, Harry Tebow, all of these folks have gone to the celestial group. Some of them that I named were non-alcoholics, but they were with us, and they loved us, and they helped us. And they're gone. Since I came here, another one is gone. Our beloved Hazel Rice, who served us so well for so many years in the General Service Office. Mrs. C. and I ran over to New York to have a minute with her before we came down here. And we're so grateful that we got to spend a little time with her. She was so ill at the time that they wouldn't let us stay long. But we got to tell her, as I got to tell Bill just a short time before he left, how much I loved him, and Hazel, how much I loved her. And I think that we should make these occasions, particularly the occasions that are set aside mainly for thinking about the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous and the God of the miracle that has made it possible for you and I to be here. And I think maybe we should make these periods of rededication to this great fellowship and to each other and to God. How very, very fortunate are we that people like these that we have named were here to work this program out for us and give it to us in the three great legacies. Our program of recovery, our program of unity, and our program of service. And I, for one, with every opportunity until I'm not breathing anymore, am going to try my best to see that you and I don't become sidetracked and don't get too interested in other things. To remember the great gift that's been given to us, and to remember that but for the grace of God, it's not possible. And to remember that unless we carry the message successfully to the alcoholic who still suffers, we'll go by the boards. Earth's little systems have their day. They have their day and cease to be. They are but broken lights of thee, but thou, O God, are more than they. Let's walk with each other and with God and be grateful for the opportunity. God bless you. Thank you very much.